You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 429. One away from 430, which is a milestone. Try to guess why.
Because in Canada, you don't have 420, you have 430.
430 is when Canadian Thanksgiving happens. I don't know. I just like to say things. That's Tom.
What's up?
Hi, Tom. Tom's joining us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I'm Adam White. I'm recording here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. So we got Thomas on the line. Do people call you Thomas ever?
Like my grandma, who's dead, yes.
Oh, well, then.
No, you know it's a good rule of thumb. When someone calls you on your phone, whether it be your home phone, I still have a home phone, or your cellular phone, and they ask for Thomas, you don't want to speak with them because they're trying to sell you something or
they're cops. You
know. Exactly.
What if it's your grandma calling from heaven, Tom?
I actually still have one grandmother, believe it or not. She's pretty old. But that was the only people who ever called me really Tommy either. It was like my grandma or just like work guys breaking balls, you know?
I don't know where that intro is supposed to go. Also, joining me...
It goes the same place everything we do goes, Adam. It goes nowhere.
That's the mantra of this show. John Gentile in Philadelphia, who apparently has resolved his persistent technical issue, although I don't know if I believe him. I don't have evidence to not believe you, but... You know.
What about you, John? Does anybody call you Johnny other than us occasionally breaking your balls?
How are you, God? That was my Max Headroom impression. Did you guys like that?
I thought you were having a stroke.
I don't think anybody like no one in my family ever calls me Johnny. Like,
What about Jonathan?
Is your brother, that's not my name.
Are you not a Jonathan? Oh, no kidding.
Jonathan is J-O-N. John is J-O-H-N. And they're actually historically they're actually two entirely separate names. John is an old Hebrew name from back before the Old Testament. Jonathan is actually a relatively modern name that developed during the Middle English era, believe it or not.
Wow. Once again, I've learned something, which is more than I'd hoped for when we started.
And John and Joshua and Jesus might all be the same name. How about that?
Yeehaw. So you're claiming to be some sort of a Messiah?
No, I'm claiming to be Jesus.
There you go.
my
dubious beginning.
My great grandmother, who didn't speak a word of English and was very Italian, whenever she spoke to any of us who were the great grandchildren, she would just add an O arbitrarily onto our names. As if that is the actual spelling of the name.
It sound Italian. So like the way cartoons treat Italian.
Right. So like I was always Adamo and my brother was Carl. So that's easy. So he was Carlo. But
Carlo is Carl.
Yeah. At least that's a real name.
And at least that's a real name. Right. But that's not his name. And you can't do that to every name. Like if one of us was named Frank, what was she going to do?
Franco. See, but that works too, actually, Adam. That was a bad example. Fred.
Adam, would you call me Jono or Giovanni?
I don't know, right? At the time, I thought, oh, that's just how these names are translated, as if, all English names had direct translations in every other language. But now, I don't think that's the case. I just think it was some old lady bullshit that... I looked over because
turns out she had a stroke and totally lost her mind.
What if she didn't know English and she was just messing with you the whole time?
she was incredibly old. Well, she was my great grandmother. She was a very old person. So I don't know what is the truth of that whole situation. She may have just been some old lady.
Are you ready to have your mind blown? Mick Jagger has a great grandson, I believe, that is older than one of his kids. Do you believe that?
Oh, that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, he's never stopped being a sexy beast.
He
could still sire children. What, he's 70, early 70s now?
He's probably like 74 now, I think.
Yeah, maybe. He could still have children. Look like Tony Randall. Wasn't he like 80 years old, still having kids?
Yeah.
Very, very responsible having kids when there's like zero chance you're going to make it to their, you know, junior high graduation.
To the middle school dance.
Yeah. Hey, whatever. People feel the need to, you know, spread their seed.
Feel the need to spread the seed.
Yes. That's, I'm going to trademark that.
I can't believe it took 429 episodes of this for my Binona to become part of the show. So there you go. What do we do on this show? We talk about things that may or may not have happened with relation to the punk rock world and punknews.org in particular over the past week. We have mail that you can, well, we have mail. People send us mail. That's how we have it. If you'd like to send us mail, it's podcast@punknews.org. That's how you accomplish that. It's an email address. John, you apparently have quite a bit of mail.
Lots of mail. Let's do three this week and then more next week, because we got three pretty long ones, but pretty well-written ones here. This is from – you can always use that podcast@punknews.org. This is from Liverpool Neil, who writes in a lot. Liverpool Neil here. This is just an email for you, John, and then I just forwarded to the Punk News Podcast account. You can talk about it now or on the show or as you wish. But I know you love The Clash and that you are one to support alternative, often radical viewpoints. So here's one for you. The Clash Mark II were actually a better band than the original Clash. Now, I don't mean to say that they wrote better songs or had the same level of musical importance, because that obviously would not be true. Although Strummer songs in the Clash Mark II period were excellent. But as a live band, the Clash Mark II blow away the original Clash. Here's the issue with the classic lineup. Live. Joe would get so amped up that his rhythm guitar playing would be sporadic at best, often out of tune, and he would play faster than the rest of the band, leading to a hideous muddle, especially at the beginning of songs. I saw the original Clash live four times between 1979 and 1982. Every one was an event, but would never rank among my best gigs. To be honest, at times they were a chaotic mess. Sometimes you wouldn't be able to tell when one song they were playing ended and the other one hit the chorus. The Clash Mark II had two guitar players, taking rhythm duties away from Joe and allowing him to concentrate on vocals. He still had a guitar, obviously, but he really didn't do that much with it. It resulted in a much clearer and coherent sound. My proof? Well, just listen. There are two shows from the Clash Mark II, and you can't tell me that the performances aren't superb. They are tight, professional, and full of energy. And they put some new spins on the old songs as well, introduced excellent new songs. Hearing the new songs performed as they were originally intended and not how they were butchered by Bernie Rhodes on Cut the Crap is mind-blowing. And then he includes two live shows, and not this episode, but next episode or the episode after that, we'll play something from one of these Clash Mark II live shows, because they are actually pretty interesting and impressive. And then Liverpool Neil continues, I just wish somebody would take the time – are you hearing me, Paul Simonon? Cut the Crap master tapes and get rid of all the shit studio effects. Maybe record some real guitar parts and release it the way it was supposed to be, as the songs were written by Joe Strummer. It's a real shame that Bernie Rhodes stuck his nose in and tried to outdo Malcolm McLaren with Buffalo Gals or Big Audio Dynamite by overproducing and turning the Clash into something they were never supposed to be. And if you want to read more about the Clash Mark II, I can't recommend the book We Are the Clash by Mark Anderson and Ralph Hibutsky enough. Anyways, let me know what you think. Check out the two shows. They are awesome.
I believe that email was prompted by a discussion in one of our – Neil and I are in like this old man punk group. Like, you guys are too young to get into it. And that's all that conversation going around. He might have initiated it. I can't remember. But there was some serious talk about it. I guess I'm willing to kind of confer to someone who's seen both versions – as far as the live show goes. As far as the recorded output, I think the proof is pretty much in the pudding.
I don't think actually, there are demos to Cut the Crap, and the demos to Cut the Crap are way better. That studio album really is bad, just bad.
It is. Boring. It is bad.
But the demos actually are a lot better, and live, they were even better than that. I didn't see either band live ever, obviously. However, I don't know if I can totally agree that Clash Mark II were better live than Clash Mark I. Clash I, of course, they weren't always amazing, but sometimes they were amazing. There's a bootleg called Capital Crisis, which I think is kind of the Clash bootleg, and it's them live during the London Calling tour, and it is an amazing, amazing show. But you know, Liverpool Neil was there, so you know, I can't conclusively argue against them.
I think it's a fascinating area of research. I don't know. Should we embark upon this?
Yes. Yeah.
You like, it's like your doctoral thesis, Adam. Well, I can see it.
I as a teenager called myself, you know, like the Clash were my favorite band. That's what I was always circling back to when I was confronting anything that I was encountering new in music. You know, do I like this as much as I like the Clash? You know, how does this compare to the Clash? Like, I was absolutely obsessed with them, but I bought into the whole narrative that Cut the Crap was bad and we should ignore it, because not only did it sound bad, but it was made with bad intentions, and it didn't have, you know, three of our four guys in it, and therefore we should all pretend
it didn't exist. Two of four, Adam. It had Strummer.
Right. Sorry. You know, but we should all pretend it doesn't exist. And the narrative that, well, I guess particularly their label built up in the late 90s and early 2000s. Retroactive, during that period of documentaries and reissues, when what was the documentary? Westway to the World, was that it?
Westway to the World, yeah.
So Westway to the World had this part in the DVD where, and this was back when people watched DVDs, and you could, which we're talking about DVD extras again, holy fuck. Tom and I were talking about DVD extras on last week's episode, and it struck us as a weird anachronism.
Without your tyranny, John, we were free. We were free to talk about DVD extras.
We were.
Yeah, I'm a real tyrant. Listen, if you read the Punk News comment section, I'm the worst tyrant there is. I mean,
John, we were talking about the DVD extra, the deleted scene from High Fidelity where John Cusack goes and gets that Sex Pistols 7-inch that was in the story last
and
week.
And I had not seen it.
So, in any case,
Adam had a school.
There was a DVD extra feature on Westway to the World where you could basically walk through the band's discography on your DVD player. I don't know. We didn't have the internet at the time, I guess. I don't know why you'd want to do that, but you could. And it stopped before Cut the Crap. I'm almost positive, or at the very least, that era was, it wasn't even footnoted in the film. It was just not included. So the band, or at least the people that were writing the band's narrative at that point, had completely, you know, what am I looking for? What's the word here? Erased, disowned. They had completely disowned that era. And I, as a loyal fan, was like, I will also disown the era, because it is clear that, you know, my heroes are disowning it. Therefore, I shall disown it. But I feel that, you know, there is an area of inquiry there, and we should pursue it. We should find it, John. We should remaster Cut. No,
what you wish for, John? John will write like a 14,000 word feature about it.
Yeah, well, I'm entirely willing to believe Liverpool Neil, though, that they were a better live band, because a lot of the times when you have to go and put together a live band around an established performer, you do put together a better live band.
Well, you get professionals. Right?
You get
your
professionals.
Buddies,
right?
The original band was your buddies, right?
Exactly, right? So you go and you put together, you know, a band that's got people that you know can play, and that's how you introduce them into that process. You don't introduce them into the process because, you know, you all came up together and wanted to start a band. So, you know, so you go, well, you know, you may as well play guitar because someone's got to do it, right? It's not that situation. You're actually looking to find people that are good and bring them in. It's the same reason why if you went to see, I mean, a few years ago I went and I saw Dylan play not too long ago, and like he sounded like a fucking dumpster, but his band was incredible. And it was because they were all of these amazing studio musicians that were just, you know, absolutely top of their game instrumentally. So I assume to some lesser degree that that is a little bit of the live effect that you'd have had with the Clash Mark II. But, you know, we don't consume these things purely on musical aesthetics. We consume them based on emotion and whatever we think we should be angry about. And we didn't give it much thought. So I'm at the point, John. I want to revisit the Clash Mark II. Liverpool Neil has given us a quest.
I'd be interested to see at the time when, I mean, Cut the Crap only came out like 2 years after Combat Rock. Like, was everyone like, oh,
was it 85, 82 and 85 maybe?
Yeah, that's it. So 3 years. I wonder, was everyone like, oh, it's the new Clash album? Or did everyone realize the Clash was over and this was like a phony Clash or a pseudo Clash? You know, I don't know. I'd be interested to see. The Clash
had already gone through so many changes by that point, John. I mean, I've told this before, but you know, like Rock the Casbah was a song that you heard on rock and roll radio stations when I was a kid.
What's on the rock? I know. I'm just saying is, I wonder was Cut the Crap regarded as the next Clash album? Because Combat Rock was their highest selling album to date. You know,
it actually had like two hits on it.
So was Combat Rock? I mean, was Cut the Crap? Were people like, oh, I can't like what's a band that's really hot, right? Well, like Effed Up is pretty big. You know, they're not gigantic, but they're pretty big. So when Effed Up puts out a new album, everyone's like, oh, it's a new Effed Up album. What are they going to do this time? We don't know. Was that what happened with Cut the Crap?
See, but Effed Up is still a totally underground band. I'd say maybe more like, what about the Blink-182 album now that Matt Skiba replaced Tom DeLonge?
Well, that's actually a pretty good comparison. I think people still do regard that as Blink-182. Don't you think so?
They do. As a matter of fact, I think a lot of people prefer it to a lot of the later era stuff. I don't know. You know, obviously, I'm the oldest guy here by a decade, and I'm way too young to – I have no recollection of the Clash breaking up. I just always sort of knew about them. I don't even remember like discovering them per se. Unlike the Ramones, where I actually remember the first time I heard the Ramones. So,
This is from Bjarte from Norway here. Our good friend Bjarte has written in a couple of times, or I think it's more like Bjart. Well, hey guys, what's up? I'm currently listening to your latest episode and the reflections concerning levels of enthusiasm at shows. And of course, Bjart is reacting to that conversation where we had where Adam said he was a little frustrated because he was looking forward to a show, but he went and he didn't have a great time because he was concerned with other things in his life. Is that correct, Adam?
I had a fine time. Yeah, you're right. I had a fine time, but I wasn't going off like these people. I don't know how to reach that level of high. I gotta use chemicals to get there.
So Bjart continues. He says, I've contemplated a little bit about this. So here's my two cents. After I stopped drinking a little over 5 years ago, going to shows proved to be a harder task than it used to be since it normally was linked to excessive drinking on my part. It took me about a year to get to a new comfort zone, and then about a year or two before I had the nerve to actually move around. I realized that most people, especially drunk people at shows, are more concerned about themselves than anything else. So I realized I was literally free to dance and jump around as I wanted to do. So I did. Around the same time, I also struck up the nerve to start talking with girls I was attracted to. That could never happen before without at least 10 beers in my belly. This goes to show that for me, it's all in the mind. And therefore, I find it interesting to hear that some of you, as me, are less likely to enjoy a show with a lot on your minds. I spent a small fortune at a Turbo Negro club show a few years ago. They only did arenas then, and all I could think about was the perfume smell from the women in front of me. It ruined everything for me. How stupid was that? So I decided if I was going to continue going to shows, I had to let that go. So I did. And I found myself dancing and singing along to a cross-punk band that occupied in an occupied building in Germany while everyone else was clinging onto their beer bottle or focusing on being miserable, or both. I took my square older brother to Prophets of Rage and almost broke my knees from jumping so much while he stood in the back. And when my girlfriend dumped me, I rode my bike a couple of hours south to a festival with the Prodigy headlining and completely lost it in the front, barely being able to move because of the pressure from the pit. Sorry about the long self-orientated letter. My point is, you got to decide what you want to do with it. If you allow it to be a problem, then it will be. If you don't like the show, you see, get up, turn off the set. It's only you who decides what your life is going to get, right? Thanks for all the great podcasts and lots of excellent food for thought during the recent years from Bjarte.
Wow, that's a lot of PMA.
Was he suggesting that if I'm not pleased with the band, I go like unplug the PA?
Yes.
This is over.
And if you can't find the plug, cut the wires.
What if it was like an opening band and you're like, oh, this band sucks. You just walk over and plug the PA.
Unfortunately, I was not on that show. So I really don't, I'm not really that privy to the conversation, but I've definitely had a couple times in the last year where like something would happen and it really soured the experience for me. Like one time in particular, I was really looking forward to going to a show, and then like three people backed out day of, like while I'm holding all the tickets that I bought for everybody. And I swear it sucked the fun out of the show for me. And then more recently, I went to a show where I watched a fight, and then I saw the wrong guy get kicked out. Ooh. And it happened sort of fast, but I didn't do anything about it. And I was just sitting there like stewing in my own juices about how I was a coward and I like didn't respond properly to the situation. I swear it sucked half the joy out of the show. It was a bummer. I hate seeing fights. I hate seeing, you know, if somebody pushes you really hard in the back, I get pissed off and it ruins the whole, you know, like I need to get over it, you know, and I will eventually, but it could take some minutes or time before I stop being like unclench my fists and like release my sphincter and sort of enjoy the show again.
What this started from was I was at the last stop on the Dirty Nils album release tour, which was a huge show in Toronto, which was a great show, and I knew every band that was playing with it. All the bands were great. The Nil were amazing, and the crowd was just going off for them. But it was one of those things where I was self-conscious of the fact that I'm standing there, and while I am enjoying myself, there's people around me that are wildly enjoying themselves more. And I find myself just like looking at that and going like, is this because like I'm not inebriated at this show? Is this because I'm maybe a little bit older than some of these people? You know, I don't want to go, is this because I'm not enjoying this band? Because I am. But I'm just looking at it and going like, there is some level of getting off that I'm not hitting, and I'm not sure why. And it was bothering me that's the case. I imagine that the real answer to it is that like, I'm not, I wasn't drunk or anything like that. And that's usually the case because I'm always traveling to go to a show. It's very rare that I could like, you know, go into a show and have like more than a beer or two with any amount of responsibleness, right? So I'm like, maybe that's it. But even if you think about it that way, then it bums me out. So I go, oh, okay, so this isn't about enjoying music. This is about substance abuse. So that's great, you asshole. Good job. So it's tough. And then I don't know. I fell down this hole of trying to sort out, you know, what's going on in my head versus what I think's going on in everyone else's head. And then suddenly I'm taken out of the moment.
Well, I always have a great time at every show I've ever been to, and I always have fun. So,
my point, the other point that I wanted to make there, and I was thinking about this the other night, and I say this to myself as a mantra, and Tom, you may have just disproven this, but I've never regretted going to a show. I can't think of a time I've regretted going to a show. And every time that I am being old and lazy and trying to make excuses for why I don't want to get in my car and drive, you know, 25 minutes to an hour to go to a gig, once I'm there and once that show is done, I've never said to myself like, oh, you shouldn't have, you know, you should have stayed home and watched Netflix. It's never happened. So that's it's something that reassures me whenever I try to, you know, flake out on things that I shouldn't do that, because I literally cannot think of a time where I've regretted it.
I've certainly regretted getting there at doors and the show doesn't start for 2.5 hours.
I've fucking done that. Yeah.
Okay, so this we'll say the rest for next week, except we'll read this last one from Miguel. Can you guys just post all the back episodes from November and December in one shot and get back to the new current episodes? It's annoying not being up to date. Thanks, from Miguel.
Oh, I'm sorry, Miguel. I thought about doing that, but then the last time that I did that, people were complaining on Twitter that all of a sudden they had 19 things in their feeds. So the plan, as we get caught back up, although telling you this makes no sense because by the time we're caught up, you will have heard this episode. But the plan, if should this ever happen again, is to kind of get one or two out a week so that it's a manageable amount of stuff. Because I know if I do go post all of them, the listener counts on the ones that are not the most recent one start to drop by like a third for each one that's in the stack, and I don't want that to happen. So I'm sorry, Miguel.
Well, you can always visit at podcast@punknews.org, and we love getting your mail. We're going to play a song in a second, but we'll just mention this, although this event might have already happened by the time you hear the podcast. On March 22nd, Punk News is throwing the Spring Social. It's going to be Natters from the UK playing their first USA show ever, excellent hardcore band. It's going to be Ellen and the Degenerates, amazing art punkers from NYC, and I think they're fantastic. A little bit of No Doubt, a little bit of Avengers, a little bit of Germs, and they are a really cool, amazing band. It's going to be the Drugettes, one of Johnny G's favorites, Punk Meets Oi from Philadelphia. That on Facebook, the trolls like calling them a mom band, and like that's actually like really sexist. Like why can't moms be in bands? You know what I mean? Like I actually think that's cool. And anyway, only one of them actually is a mom. I think is it one or no two of them are moms. Anyway, they're cool. Drugettes are awesome, and the headliner will be none other than Hardy Flanagan celebrating the 30th anniversary of the crossover Best Wishes album. So he's going to play almost all of Best Wishes, if not all of Best Wishes. He's going to play almost all of Age of Quarrel, and then he's also going to play some of his awesome brand new stuff. It's at a place called Ortlieb, which is only 120 capacity, so I think this will sell out. So if you want to go, you definitely should get tickets beforehand. And it's a smaller venue than Hardy usually plays, and it's just going to be awesome, man. It's going to like I've seen the Hardy Flanagan band before twice, and they are amazing and awesome and intense, and they just rip it up, and this is going to be cool. So you all should come to this event for sure.
120 capacity. That's an intimate room.
Indeed, Tom. Indeed. And if you're hearing this before February 22nd, you'll probably want to get tickets before then, because I'm going to be handing out flyers at the hardcore – well, this is the hardcore event of the season, but the second hardcore event of the season. And I think once I hand out flyers there, it's going to sell out. So this is going to be cool and fun and awesome. And also I'm excited to really – like most Hardy shows, they open with, you know, NYHC bands, which I'm pretty sure Hardy's kind of sick of seeing. And so we're opening up with three definitely punk or hardcore punk bands. So I think it's going to be a really interesting mix and should be a lot of fun. So you should go.
John, are you going to get stabbed?
Adam, can we please not try to defame the person that I'm throwing a show for while I'm trying to move tickets for the show?
I'm not trying to defame that, but I just know that there are various situations involving various New York hardcore bands that you have joked about in the past that might come back to bite you in the ass.
Listen, everyone's poetically been cool so far. It's going to be cool. Adam, stop trying to get me into a serious jam.
Ah, I suppose. Yeah, everyone should go to the show. John puts on good shows, and they are usually in every case, they are not what you would expect from some conventional boring old promoter. John has his P.T. Barnum hat on all times.
And here's the question for the. Of course, we're going to push the envelope for this show, but I don't know how punk newsy I'm going to make the show. If you've been to a punk news show, you know what I'm talking about. We do lots of wacky stuff. This crowd will not be the usual punk news crowd, so I don't know how far I want to push the wacky hijinks. You know what I mean?
You're not going to dance around in a goofy suit in front of these folks.
We'll see.
Yeah, John, I don't think you should downplay this stabbing thing. I think that you could draw – there's a whole crowd that will come just, you know, speculating that you'll get stabbed. I mean
– Can we stop defaming the person that I'm trying to celebrate here? Listen –
the good news is, like you said, by the time this episode gets in the news feed, the show will be over. It'll be too late.
I'll be over by the time this gets in the news feed. Listen, so anyway, this is Philadelphia, Ortlieb's March 22nd. 120 tickets. It'll most likely sell out. It's going to be awesome. Let's listen to one of the tracks from Best Wishes, a seminal album that is one of the first, maybe not the very first, but one of the first, and certainly one of the most iconic albums to blend thrash metal with hardcore punk. This is Death Camps by the Cro-Mags. We'll be right back. And we're back, and these two knuckleheads trying to get me in trouble here.
Listen. Did you say that was Major Quarrel? That's from Best Wishes, isn't it?
Death Cancer from Best Wishes, yeah.
Did you say that? Oh, I don't know. I don't remember. Maybe I heard you wrong.
Well, anyway, I actually think it's really interesting that he's celebrating, because everyone's like, Age of Quarrel, Age of Quarrel. And listen, Age of Quarrel, I mean, that's the album. That's an amazing album. But I do think it's cool that he is celebrating Best Wishes, which isn't an album that gets heralded that much. And maybe it should, because, I mean, honestly, I reevaluated it myself. It's a good album, man.
I love Best Wishes. Mm-hmm. I love it. As a matter of fact, it was actually the first one I heard was Best Wishes. And I know you defend their later stuff, but I think only the two albums are essential. But Age of Quarrel and Best Wishes, I love Best Wishes.
Well, speaking of things that people love, Bouncing Souls, they're also celebrating their 30th anniversary, just as the Cro-Mags are celebrating, or Holly's celebrating the 30th anniversary of Best Wishes. The Bouncing Souls are celebrating their own 30th anniversary. To celebrate that, they're going to put out a 6-inch EP. A six-song EP. The EP is called Crucial Moments. It's going to be through Rise Records, which releases pretty much every long-running punk record, on March 15. And it's going to come with a book, and they're also going to tour. And on the tour, they will be supported by a whole bunch of different bands, depending on where you're at, including the Bronx, Strike Anywhere, Off With Their Heads, Casualty, Swinging Artists, Crazy in the Brains, Sharp Shock, and Barstool Preachers. They even released a song for the title track called Crucial Moments. Bouncing Souls, boys. Have they not gotten their perhaps due celebration, if only because they never broke up? If Bouncing Souls broke up in 95, would they be a more heralded band than they are now? Even though they do get a fair level of respect, for sure.
I am a proud owner of a hoodie, which is a Bouncing Souls 20th anniversary hoodie. So I feel that this is a band that that both celebrates and self-celebrates quite on the reg. I find a lot of the love that people have for the Bouncing Souls very, very heartening and very, I want to say, adorable without making that sound infantilizing. A lot of our punk news crew have a huge soft spot for the Bouncing Souls, and they get really super excited whenever they do anything. And their love is so pure for this band that it's infectious, and it makes me happy to see. I'm not totally I'm a Fairweather fan, I guess. I was a regular follower of them during during the like late 90s, early 2000s Epitaph era. What was the name of the record? Shit.
Gold Rush?
Probably How I Spent My Summer Vacation.
No, specifically not that. Hopeless Romantic. Hopeless Romantic was very important in my general punk rock upbringing. Because what year was that? Was it 98, 99?
Oh, that was before How I Spent My Summer. I think 98.
Right? 98. So I was... Was it 98? It came out in 99. Yeah, okay.
Summer Vacation was 2000. Let me see.
Yeah, no. Well, Hopeless Romantic was definitely 99.
Summer Vacation was 2001, so maybe it was 99.
Right. So Hopeless Romantic was 99. So like I was in high school at the time when that record came out. It was hugely important to me for that reason. It was one of the first like modern day Epitaph-ish punk bands that I was into. And that was probably one of the first records from like that, like Epifat skate punk scene that I had picked up. So it meant a lot to me. I haven't listened to it in years, but it probably still means a lot to me if I go in and listen to it. I totally understand the love that everyone has for Summer Vacation that came out after that. But to me, Hopeless Romantic is like the canonical, you know, Bouncing Souls experience. And then going forward with that, there was that record Anchors Away where they got very mature and mm-hmm. and indie rocky and melodic. And
yeah, there was no joke song on that album.
There was no joke song on that album, but I actually think that album is really good. Like I think that album is like, from a songwriting perspective, to me, that's sort of the peak. And then, you know,
I think the Gold album is a little underrated too. I think the Gold album is really good. I think that was their last great album. That was about 2006 or so.
Yeah, and I remember liking that, but I don't remember as much about it. It wasn't as impactful on me. But
I bet you if you went back and listened to it, there a few songs would you'd start singing along almost instantly.
Yeah, and I think I have the same perspective as you. Where sort of everything after that, I don't want to say necessarily that they were treading water or anything like that, but they were like, it feels like they, you know, they had a sound, they had a legacy, they had an established fan base. And it feels to me as a Fairweather fan that everything after that was something for the fans. Because it was like they did that Comet project where they released like one song a month until they had
that was the Ghost of the Boardwalk.
Ghost of the Boardwalk, right? And then Comet was after that, yeah. But like, everything after that, and this new
that album was very wimpy. I mean, it was just there was hardly a punk rock song to be found.
But this new song, what is the name of it? The one we're talking about.
I have not listened to it.
Okay. I'm just trying to remember good? What the hell it's. It fits my criticism of modern day Bouncing Souls, which is that it is a Bouncing Souls sounding song. John is clearly moving.
Is someone getting their dumpster empty?
I was gonna say John's unloading a transport truck right now.
Back him up, boys. Back.
Beep, beep, beep.
No. So the song is called Crucial Moments. So this new Bouncing Souls song.
That's the name of the album.
Yeah. To me, it is very much a. It is a song about about being in the Bouncing Souls, which is great. And the video sort of goes with that. It's full of archival footage of the band playing. It's just, it's a wash in this nostalgic sentiment that I think really plays to people that have been fans of this band for going on 30 years. And if you're a super fan of this band and you listen to the song or watch this video, it likely fills you with all sorts of warm and happy feelings about your history with the Bouncing Souls. And I get that. That said, it's not really the kind of thing that I'm into because, like, you know, I like the Bouncing Souls, but I'm not at that level. I never achieved that specific point of enlightenment.
I would like to go see this tour. The Chicago and Detroit dates it's just a solid lineup. I can't. It's a. The Bronx, Barstool Preachers, and somebody else. I can't remember, but it's a cool lineup. I would definitely – I don't know that I will make it to see it, but I would be up for seeing this tour.
Yeah, and the Bronx, Swing and Utters.
While you were waxing poetically, I literally just ordered a copy of How I Spent My Summer Vacation on vinyl. I mean, like 2 minutes ago. It's going to be here in 2 days.
I have distinct memories of being in university – and not having a car or anything like that and living off campus and having to get from where we were living to school. And we walked through this like cow pasture place that was fucking cold and snow was blowing and it was just shitty and freezing. But I had my iPod, you know, earbuds in, and I was listening to How I Spent My Summer Vacation, and I was just having a glorious time trudging through the Canadian winter to get to school.
I still love it.
Listen, I'm going to need somebody to sign for this. I'm not letting you drive away until somebody signs for this. I need to prove to...
When you go see them live, Adam, that's all. They still play half of that album.
There's a point to me where I am...
They hardly play any of their new stuff.
I feel like I'm sort of... And this happened very early for me. I feel like I'm kind of sick of that record. I know you just bought one, so I don't want to shit on it or anything.
Well, no, and I have the CD in the basement. I've been kind of. But no, that's fine. Listen, you don't have to listen to it, Adam. You're not invited to the listening party in 2 days when it shows up. I got a really good price on it too.
John, as someone who, when they were a teenager, had to unload crates of produce from produce trucks, which I'm sure is something you had to do.
was doing it as late as about 3 months ago.
John just got a delivery of 50 crates of new records. So that's what it was.
I don't want to triangulate John's life too much, but you come from a hearty stock of grocers, so.
Yeah, I love working at the produce market. Like if my dad needs help once in a while, I love going and helping out. Well, also, as your parents get older, you appreciate spending time with them more and more. But I still love working in the produce market. I really do.
You guys are like so stereotypical. You're both Italian, and you both of your parents own like produce stores. I mean, it's what are the odds, right? Or at least you have
no. I worked in produce. My father was an auto mechanic.
What are the odds? The answer is like 1 out of 2.
Yeah,
yeah, it's like 50%. Yeah.
But
your grandmother just randomly added O's to the end of your name.
Yes, although I can't escape the stereotype because do you know why my last name is White?
I remember you saying that.
I know this story, but go ahead.
Well, my last name is White, as I understand it, because there were two Bianco families in Niagara Falls that in the 20s or whatever it was ran grocery stores, and this being the pre-computer era, you know, if you ordered a shipment of apples to the Bianco grocery store, it would show up at the wrong Bianco grocery store, and at some point my family was just like, fuck it, and just changed the name.
See, I thought I remember you telling the story like that. One, like the other family was crooked, so you like changed your name.
I've heard so many versions of this over the years that the version I just told is the one that I've settled on because it is the most realistic from an Occam's razor standpoint. Before that, it was the other family didn't pay their bills or whatever, and they got the debt collectors coming. But there were years ago when I was young, and I thought this story was lame, where I was like, well, it was clearly like racism. Right, like people, because of the war, you know, they wouldn't want to do business with Italians, so you got a good English name, and they would do business with you. And I bet you that wasn't fucking true at all. But that was what I thought. That's what I believe.
I don't think anybody ever really hates because Italians are wonderful. Everyone always likes Italians. Wherever we go, we never have a problem. People love us because we're good people, nice people. We know how to cook. We have a good time. A little bit
literally,
of wine.
Literally, Mussolini was the only one ever not liked.
That's true.
And they pretty much tore him to pieces.
If you read the Guinness Book of World Record, the world's most liked race is the Italians. It's true.
clearly. All right, let's move on here. So we really veered off Bouncing Souls
into genetic superiority.
I guess. All right, here. So this next one has a pretty interesting wrinkle on it. So first of all, the fun news, the news that everyone's excited about, was that Bikini Kill announced that they were getting back together. They were getting back together to play 3 shows in Los Angeles, in Brooklyn, and in New York. And this was happening in April, May, and June. So 1 a month. The lineup for the show is going to be Kathleen Hanna, Toby Vail, Kathy Wilcox, and they're going to be joined by guitarist Erica Dawn Lyle for the shows. This is going to be the band's first gigs since 1997, and that is all they've announced so far. They haven't talked about further touring, haven't talked about recording new music or anything like that, but so 3 shows is what they announced. And everyone lost their minds on the internet because Bikini Kill is one of these bands that is just much loved. And then the tickets went on sale, and they sold out in 1 second because of bots. So
literally 1 second.
Literally one second. And when the tickets all showed up on the resale sites, they were going sometimes for like up to 9 times their value. I guess the, for example, like the New York and LA shows, they were selling tickets for like between, I think, $40 and $45 for these shows, which is, hey, expensive for a punk band, but I get it. You know, you're a much loved band on a reunion gig. Sure. Make your money. That's cool. Anyways, though, 3 days later, you go on to StubHub. The cheapest ticket you could find was $104. The most expensive you could find was $775, which mathematically 17 times the original asking price. So all these
fans paying that, that's insane.
Well, I mean, I don't know if anyone's paying it, but that's what they're selling it for. But in any case, all these fans had the worst whiplash where they were stoked. They were so happy to go see like one of these like seminal Riot Girl bands back together. And the tickets sell out instantly. And then they're faced with the insult of all of these fucking bots trying to sell them for $800. So the band put out a statement. And the statement reads, Hi, everyone. We wanted to apologize to anyone who had a bad experience trying to get tickets to our upcoming shows. We weren't aware of the pre-sale for people with a certain credit card in New York until it was too late, and that will not happen in the future. Also, as soon as we realized there were problems, we tried to put as many obstacles in front of the scalpers as we could and are trying to figure out a better solution going forward. Thanks to all the interest and support for these shows. It's beyond anything we expected. We are excited to play for you. So what should we talk about here? I mean, on the one hand, I don't know what that means. I don't know how they put obstacles in front of the scalpers. Like, they didn't get in a hacker battle with them, right? So how do we want to approach this? You want to talk about Bikini Kill? You want to talk about, like, crazy internet scalpers?
I'll take approaches. Bikini Kill rules. Everyone knows they rule. It's tough to say they're overrated because they're not. They're an extremely important band that came along right at, kind of at the eight when punk was becoming – had kind of at the apex of its misogynist side, which all dudes, all super violent hardcore. Bikini Kill came out and kind of, you know, smashed that back to their credit. Great band and also just great music and great message. I think one of the interesting things is as soon as they announced a reunion, so many people were like, time to cash in. Psh, psh, psh. It's like can a band like get back together and it not be strictly a cat? I just don't see Kathleen Hanna like you know putting her fingers together and say I know how we'll make a lot of money. We'll do a reunion tour, you know, like maybe.
Well, and they're not playing like hockey rinks like the Misfits are. I mean, they're playing theaters, you know.
So it's like I do kind of hate how punks are so jaded about everything, like. I don't think it's a strict. I mean, like as Tom points out, if they did a hockey arena thing, they might have been able to pull it off, you know. Or if they really wanted to, they would do it like a festival, you know, for half a mil or something like that. They definitely could have done that, you know.
Yeah, Coachella or yeah, exactly.
So and actually, as a side, I kind of think Flag blew it that way. Flag, I mean, well, actually, I don't think they blew it, but Flag did their first shows were a ton of amazing club shows. Some of the best shows I ever saw. But I think Flag would have made a lot more money if they did a festival first instead of tiny club shows. But that's beside the point at this point. So I don't think this was a cash-in. And also, I will say, man, the point that Bikini Kill got so much backlash with regards to that issue only goes to show how much sexism there really is. You know, like when Jawbreaker got back together, people weren't like, time to cash in. People were like, oh, yeah, it's Jawbreaker time. But when Bikini Kill does it, they're like, you sell out, you know, time to cash in. So it just goes to show.
Don't you think that's just because Bikini Kill was such an overtly political punk band and Jawbreaker was essentially a pop punk band that sang songs about drinking and girls and stuff?
Yeah, but that might be part of it too. So fair, but there's certainly sexism involved, and this is not a cash out move or a cash in move, however you want to put it. However, I did hear someone say a classic move is to announce a few shows that will sell out immediately to drive up interest, and then announce a much bigger tour. You know, so if that happens,
I just don't think Bikini Kill has that big a drawing power. If we're being honest,
I think they do.
Great band, important band, but they can't play secondary markets.
They could, Tom.
I don't think so. They could hit Chicago, Detroit, and like that, but they're going to be playing 500 seaters. I'm telling you, they're not. I'm not trying to piss on Bikini Kill. I think they're a fine band. I just don't think they have that big much drawing power outside of major cities.
I think the most important angle to this is that as soon as Bikini Kill emerged in the news, Courtney Love reignited her feud with Kathleen Hanna, and you know,
boy, talk about somebody that can't draw a fly,
and called them the biggest hoax in the history of rock and roll.
I like how you guys know how that got started. What's interesting about the Courtney Love Bikini Kill feud is like with most feuds, like each side says, no, we were in the right. With this one, Courtney Love was clearly in the wrong. It was at Lollapalooza 97, I think it was. And Melissa Oftermar, she said to Courtney Love, hey, look, it's Kathleen Hanna. Courtney, you should go give her some candy because there's candy here. And so Courtney Love took the candy and like hurled it at Kathleen Hanna's face and tried to slap her. Like Kathleen Hanna was like minding her own business, and like Courtney Love like attacked her. So it's like strictly one sided, you know. But listen, I think history is judged who's the victor in that competition.
Would the whole reunion be huge?
No.
Would that draw huge crowds?
Actually, yes. Because actually, it would draw probably bigger crowds, not because it'd be like more of a shocker or whatever, just because Hole was a radio band and Bikini Kill was not a radio band. And Hole's got one mega hit, you know, Bikini Kill doesn't have any radio hits, you know, even though Bikini Kill is definitely the better band. Although, actually, the older I get, the more I like Hole. I think Hole's actually kind of a good band, to tell you the truth.
That's what I say.
I feel like Hole could easily reunite and then go play those Montebello Rockfest sized festivals that just have, you know, 900 bands playing, and all of like the big radio bands from the 90s are there, and there's just throngs of people, and I don't want to be there.
Like a 52-year-old Courtney Love, like in a baby doll dress.
If that's what she wants to do, but they could play those shows.
$45 though, is that fair for Bikini Kill?
That's pretty steep, but if you're a fan, I mean, you're playing 1,000-seat venues. It's smaller venues. If you're a fan, you pay it.
I feel that like that's one of those things where like I would look at it and go like, and this is what I did. I looked at it and I thought to myself like, oh man, that's expensive. But on the other hand, like when else are you ever going to get to see Bikini Kill? If they were to turn around and just do the Pixies thing and just, you know, like reunite and then just be a band and start releasing stuff and tour with Weezer and never stop being around, then I would feel pretty bad about paying $45. I'd feel a little bit duped. But,
but once again, Pixies much bigger band in the big picture.
Right, but they reunited and everyone freaked out. Yeah. But then they never went away. now they're just here. Yeah. There's a fucking Pixies show in my living room right now. Like they're not gone. So I don't know if they can continue to, you know, charge the nostalgia premium. And at a certain point, you're just lover boy. You're just playing. Well,
it'd be interesting. You know, they ran their own label, and they were very much a DIY band. I wonder if they were profitable back in their day.
I definitely think Bikini Kill was,
because if you ever watched the L7 documentary Pretend We're Dead, which is I recommend it, it's very good. But L7 was playing all over the world. They had major label contracts. They were poor. Never made any money the first time around. They're actually, and they were apart for years. I actually, as far as Riot Girl type bands go, L7 would probably be my favorite of the bunch. And then Babes in Toyland, and then Bikini Kill. But, you know, I never saw Bikini Kill of all those bands, so I'd be interested.
I'd go for $40. If they do a big tour and then say $40, I'll go. I'd like to go, we'll see.
All right, John, we have another story here. It's about a bench, so this is a perfect situation where I'm going to walk away and go to the bathroom and then come back, and you guys will still be talking about a bench. So here you go.
All right. Well, anyways, so Black Sabbath, after, let's see here, about 51 years of being a band and putting out literally over a dozen albums, I think about 17 or 18 albums, after about 5 singers, after literally hundreds of tours, Black Sabbath are now getting their reward. They're getting a bench in Birmingham, where they're from. The bench is handmade stainless steel and was forged in the city. And of course, Birmingham is famously a metal production town. And of course, Tony Iommi famously cut off 2 tips of his fingers working in a sheet metal factory. The bench includes images of Ozzy Osbourne, Tony Iommi, Geezer Butler, and Bill Ward. And it says on it, Geezer, Ozzy. Oh, interestingly, it says Geezer first. How do you like that?
Yeah, I thought that was a little strange, too.
Geezer, Ozzy, Tony, Bill, made in Birmingham, 1968. And it's going to be on what will soon be called the Black Sabbath Bridge on Broad Street. If you take a look at the bridge, it's actually a pretty jolly-looking bridge. It's not ominous and spooky at all. meanwhile, Bill Ward will finally get a star in the city's Walk of Stars. But quite interestingly, the other 3 original Black Sabbath members already have stars. Then they've had them for a long time. So 2 things, I guess, to take from here. Tom, is this cool and fun and interesting? Or is it co-opting by, I guess, decent society of something that they used to hate and repudiate, but now are co-opting for monetary and hipness reasons? So that's the first question. And the second question is, man, I'll tell you, I have just lost so much respect for Ozzy over the past 20 years. I mean, he, like the fact that they cut Bill Ward out of getting a star because Ozzy hates him, you know, it's so lame. Like, and people say, you know, Sharon's a monster. Sharon is a monster, but she's only a monster at Ozzy's direction. That is, if Ozzy, you know, Sharon represents Ozzy, and if Ozzy said, Sharon, don't sue Tony Iommi for trademark when he's got cancer because he's got cancer, she couldn't. If he said, you know what, Sharon, I want Bill Ward in the band, don't kick him out, then she couldn't kick him out. If Ozzy said, you know what, Sharon, at my Ozfest, I don't want you to do pay for play for the opening bands. We'll pay them just a little bit because it's dropping the bucket for us, you know.
I don't know that, John. I don't know anything about the relationship. I don't know that she doesn't rule things with an iron fist. I don't even know that Ozzy is competent enough to really even know what's going on.
But the only reason he's not competent is because he's drunk and drugged himself into a stupor. So it's still his own fault. I don't disagree that at this current time, maybe he doesn't have the ability to say, Sharon, I think what you're doing is not cool, so you got to stop it. He might not have that ability now. But he certainly had that ability in 1996 when all the bullshit, you know, started. Or 1998. Dude,
he tried to retire like 25 years ago, but you know.
But that's no. I mean, honestly, Tom, if he crossed his arms and said, "Sharon, I am not going on tour," then he wouldn't go on tour. If he crossed his arms and said, "Sharon, do not sue Tony Iommi when he has cancer for his trademark," you know,
their lifestyle necessitates him working.
Well,
anyway, you know. So the thing is, you know, the Bill Ward thing. So I saw Black Sabbath two times with the full original lineup. And it was late 90s, early 2000s. I have a ticket stub for one of them. Once was at Ozfest, and once was at the arena here with Pantera opening, believe it or not. And so it soured sometime after, like, 2001 because, yeah, he didn't do the farewell tour, which is a joke.
Honestly. No, but he did in 2006, which is the tour that I saw, and then that was the last tour that he did was the 2006-2007 okay. tour.
But as far as this whole thing goes, you know, I guess here's the bottom line. I don't know that I'm ever be in Birmingham, England, but if I was ever close, I would go see this stuff now, being a Black Sabbath fan. I'm sure the town turned their nose up at them for many, many years, but now that it's not like difficult to be a fan of the music anymore, I'm sure they're embracing it. And I think they should put an Iron Man statue.
Yeah, actually, an Iron Man, like what they should have done, I agree.
Like the old school Iron Man statue, like the one the song's about, which I think was in Russia, but I'm not, or Germany, I can't remember. But yes. And also, yes, Ozzy's a tool.
Yeah, man. He could have like retired as the king, you know, like even higher than Halford, higher than Tom Araya, higher than Thomas Gabriel.
Listen, but here's the thing too. Ozzy made all his money as a solo artist. The original Black Sabbath drank and drugged away all their money. Never had any money, bad contracts. So he made all his money as a solo artist. His solo material is lousy.
Yes, I agree.
I never particularly cared for any of his solo music, even with Randy Rhoads or whatever.
It's corny, right? It's
lightweight 80s pop metal.
No one admits to this. I mean, the first two albums kind of rock, but Crazy Train is like a dumb song. You know, it's dumb.
It's lightweight. It's pop metal. It is really no different than what Quiet Riot was doing, who was pretty much a joke county fair band. Well, most of the key guys are dead now, but... But yeah, it had no substance to it. It was nothing special at all. Black Sabbath was dark, ominous, amazing music. Even somebody like an Adam, who I know is not a metal guy, I bet you he can appreciate the Black Sabbath to a certain extent. And you don't have to appreciate Ozzy Soul stuff. It's just weak.
To a degree, Tom, you have to give Sharon credit in that whereas Ozzy could have just been another, could have just become another cornball 80s guy, you know, that no one gave a shit about anymore.
He was a cornball 80s guy. It's just people cared about him for whatever reason.
No, but that's what I'm saying is people maintain a certain reverence and respect and even a certain, you know, that kind of sinister element with Ozzy throughout the 80s and 90s, whereas a lot of other artists, they just became like crappy people they don't, no one cares about. So Sharon, for some reason, was able to. I mean, Sabbath put out a lot of mediocre albums. You know, I mean, you know, after the original run, and Ozzy.
Well, the fact of the matter is, the last couple Ozzy albums weren't that great. If we're being honest, they made
only like the first three are any good. The rest are like terrible.
I think you can argue the first six are good, but
Ozzy albums or Sabbath albums?
Sabbath albums. No, no. Oh, Ozzy.
No, no.
No, Ozzy albums are good.
I think the first six Sabbath albums are all amazing, almost equally so. Maybe Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath is a little uneven, maybe, you know. But
a couple of great songs, but yeah, it's a real filler too.
Yeah, yeah, it's not bad. It's got some filler on it, you know. But I mean, like, even though Ozzy's put out crappy album after crappy album, people are still like, it's Ozzy, you know, and part that's due to Sharon, you know. But the drawback side is that Ozzy has been one of the most vicious, famous musicians in the business by just destroying people that create, like, I think the frustration with Ozzy is with guys like Bob Daisley, with guys like Randy Rhoads, with guys like I'm trying to think of some of the other lesser known people. Well, even Tony Iommi and even Bill Ward,
Jake Ely,
great example. Those are the guys that made Ozzy. Without them, Ozzy would have been. Of course, Ozzy would have been Ozzy without Ozzy. But Ozzy needed those guys to, you know, kind of market himself. Like, he doesn't even write any lyrics. Like,
yeah, he doesn't play guitar. Yeah, he doesn't write riffs. And
Ozzy's kind of all show and no substance in that. Like, by surrounding himself with talented people, that's how he became him. But of course, David Bowie's extremely talented. But David Bowie also surrounded himself with talented people: Brian Eno, Carlos Alomar, what's his name, Klaus Nomi.
However, Gabriels.
Mick Ronson, of course. But David Bowie never trashed those guys, or he never tried to write them out of the David Bowie history. He kept them in the David Bowie history as he moved on. Whereas Ozzy Osbourne, he kind of uses an artist, and then he kind of erases – he literally erases them from history. Tom, as you remember, they took on the first two Ozzy albums, they removed –
they re-recorded them.
Yeah. Yep.
They recorded the drums and the bass over. Robert Trujillo – current Metallica bassist, former Suicidal Tendencies bassist, former Ozzy Osbourne band, yeah, recorded over the originals.
What a scab, I'll tell you.
Scab. Did you see, John? I'm sure you saw the news story recently. Adam's just sitting there, like,
yeah, the guy that's dying, you know, yeah.
The drummer who played on the original, I think, first two albums that got re-recorded, Ozzy never gave him his platinum records or anything, and he's dying of cancer, and a very magnanimous Ozzy, through Sharon, I'm sure, sent him his platinum album so they can hang him on the wall for like a couple months before he bites the dirt.
Well,
master you are, Ozzy.
At least they did that, you know. At least they did do that.
Yeah,
know?
But why did he do it, John? For good publicity? I mean,
yeah,
you know,
it's true. Yeah, that's true.
I hate to be cynical, but that's kind of what I do.
You're right. So anyway, the point being is Ozzy really. I mean, even though. But of course, Ozzy doesn't give a shit. Do you think Ozzy cares if people think he's the master of darkness? He doesn't give a shit. You know what I mean?
I don't think he knows what's going on. I'm telling you, he's out of it, dude. He's out of it.
Anyway, meanwhile, Halford is still friggin' Halford, baby. That's why Halford's the king.
Halford's got a sharp mind. He's still got a sharp mind and a sharp voice.
But I mean, like, if you follow Halford on Instagram, he's like hilarious, you know?
Is he really?
Yeah, Halford is hilarious, you know.
Oh,
so the point being is Ozzy's kind of not that he cares, but I think in the music community mindset, Ozzy is forever tarnished. Whereas Tony Iommi, I got, is kind of forever sainted, you know. Even, you know, that's the choice he made, and maybe it wasn't the wrong choice. He's super rich, and he's the most famous out of all of them, you know. But and does he care? The answer is probably not. So I guess it worked out. That's what's frustrating is. That's what's frustrating, and that's how I'll cap this conversation off. Is what's frustrating is he acted ruthlessly, cold-heartedly, and viciously towards everyone that supported him, and he just, you know, he sued Tony Iommi when Tony Iommi had cancer, which is monstrous, you know, when he could have waited, you know, which is monstrous, and he won in the end, and that he's got tons of money. He's super famous, and he doesn't really care about what, you know, the music community thinks of him or not. He doesn't give a shit. So that's what's frustrating, is that he did all these kind of pretty bad things, and he wins, you know. So whatever. Mm. But he got a bench, you know. So Adam, when do you get your bench in Niagara?
Oh, fuck. What? Huh? What's going on right now?
Just go staple your name to a bench, put like the Adam White bench.
When I have a bench, John, it's going to be in the news because it's going to shoot fire and
It's got to be really close to the actual falls themselves, so we can just sit there and watch people go over and over the falls in a barrel, which I assume happens several times a day.
The only people that go over the falls at this point are suicides, and it's really sad. So anyway,
so they don't even use barrels.
Nope.
I mean, I want like an old fashioned wooden barrel.
The last cool thing to go over the falls was at some point in the 90s, I believe it was. Some fucking maniac went over in a jet ski with a parachute on the back of it.
And did he live?
I don't believe he did. But if you're going to do it.
So it's a happy ending, because anybody dumb enough to do that.
Hold on. I want to get this story right. Niagara Falls. If you search for Niagara Falls jet ski, Google autofills the word death after that, which is not what I was trying to shoot for. But hold on here. When was this?
Tom, you think you could ever be a daredevil? I don't think I could do it.
I don't know. Niagara Falls jet ski death.
What I think is amazing is some of the pageantry that was 1995 that someone went over in a jet ski to their death. Yeah, I mean, it's sad that the dude died, but on the other hand, if you're going to go fucking jet ski over Niagara Falls.
His parachute didn't open.
Oh, there's pictures of him in midair. My God.
Did he mean to die, or he thought he was going to make it?
Well, he had a parachute, but, if you're going to do that.
Yep, there he is.
Yeah, there's a picture of, it's like an old grainy black and white newspaper photo where, like, he is.
So close.
He's
so
in the
close.
Air. He has his fist in the air.
Did he do it as like a publicity stunt? Like, was the media there?
He is listed as a Californian daredevil, so I've got to imagine
he graduated from stuntman college.
Talk about
disappointing your parents, huh?
There's a place in Niagara Falls where they have collected a lot of the barrels that people went over in. And like put them in this museum, so you can kind of like wander around and just like touch them, and like you can touch them too, because they do not care. This is not a good museum. This is just a it's a sideshow next to a tourist attraction.
Roadside attractions.
So you can go in and half of these barrels are probably full of tourists throwing their Coke cups in them and stuff like that. But there's one that is my absolute favorite. That someone went over in, which is called the Plungosphere. Which, if you want to do something cool, you do it in the Plungosphere. And it was basically a giant rubberized sphere, basically, where this guy thought, like, fuck barrel, I'm going to make, like, a big orb. And I'm going to go over inside of this orb. And I think the guy lived, but the Plungosphere is really impressive. And it has an impressive name. Speaking of impressive, someone should play a song. Is it me? Is it Tom?
Don't care.
Tom, play a song.
Okay. Let me get my Gmail out here.
I love whenever this comes up, you're completely befuddled.
I have this technology problem, and I Adam and I last week, John, you weren't here, but I was like, I have all these download codes and all these LPs, and I never cash them in. I'm like, maybe I could download some MP3s quick from some vinyl and play it. But I'm actually going to play a song by a band called the Ramblin' Boys of Pleasure, which we actually ran a news piece on a while back.
Which is a Lawrence Arms reference, right?
Yes.
It's a Pogues reference, Adam, and actually it's a reference back even further to kind of just Irish society in general. Blammo!
Wasn't that the tattoo that Laura Jane Grace had to had blacked out on her arm? Wasn't that the one that her and the dude from Lawrence Arms had or something? The Ramblin' Boys of Pleasure? Wasn't that the?
A good 90% of Laura's arm is black. There's probably a lot of shit.
Yeah,
under there.
No, her one arm is totally blacked out. But I know at some point I thought she had the I thought her and what's the guy? Oh, Brandon from Lawrence Arms. Yeah, Brandon Kelly. I thought they had like the Ramble Boys of Pleasure.
So, despite whatever bullshit John just said, whatever band you're about to play is named after Lawrence Arms.
Or some
Irish. But that's from a Pope reference, I'm saying.
Right. Well, but the band that named themselves that because of the Lawrence Arms.
If I call myself the Rolling Stone Boys, the people would be like, oh, you're named after the Rolling Stones, but not really, you know.
No, I'm actually named after the 17th century German stones that rolled down. Yeah, Anyway, the Ramblin' Boys, a pleasure. The name of the song is also sort of derivative. It's called Joyce Jawbreaker. And it's sort of like a folky punk thing. It's not really my thing.
I'm going to go but lie they, down.
But they sent me the MP3, so they're today's lucky winner. Anyway, this is the Ramblin' Boys of Pleasure with Joyce Jawbreaker. When you got no time.
We're back, John. We have a couple stories here that we nixed last week when technical issues consumed your ability to be on the podcast. So I'm just gonna kick back and let you roll with these.
Yeah, we don't have to cover every. You know, we've been going a little long, so we can cut. Adam, I'll defer to you when you want to cut the episode off. But let's cover this one thing at least. Speaking of Black Sabbath, Sleep is going to release. Is this their? This will be their first true live album. They did release a 12-inch EP once that was live, but it was actually kind of like an official bootleg, in that it's bootleg level quality, but they officially released it. But they're going to release their first official live record. It's called Sleep Live at Third Man Records, and it is recorded direct to acetate when the band played at the Third Man Records venue. And of course, they're touring and supporting their most recent album, The Sciences, which was their comeback album and essentially their first new album in about 20 years. Anyways, I've seen Sleep live four times, and I saw them on the Dope Smoker tour, the Dope Smoker comeback tour, and Sleep is absolutely astounding live. I mean, Sleep is absolutely, absolutely, absolutely amazing live. When they do play live, they play their songs really long. Like they'll take like a 7-minute song and make it 12 minutes. They'll take a 4-minute song and make it 10 minutes. Like every song they play is long, slow, and heavy. And if you like Sleep or, you know, stoner metal, and I do, then the Sleep is the band. I mean, I don't have to tell you about Sleep. Sleep's amazing. What's interesting about this Live at Third Man Records record is that they're not releasing a CD version, and I believe they're not even releasing a digital version. They're only releasing a vinyl version, which breaks the entire concert up over 4 records or 8 sides, which basically means there's about 1 to 2 songs per side of every record. And I gotta say, like, I know cool stuff's on records these days, and a lot of stuff is being reissued on record that was never on record to begin with. I just don't get, like, the reissue or new album on a vinyl record, because as an album, I understand it, you know, it's two sides. That's part of the format. That's part of the artistic statement. This is this movement. And the flip side is the second movement, but a live show is one continuous thing, you know? And so to break it up over eight sides of a record, not only seems tedious to me, but it seems, I guess, annoying and it interrupts the flow. I know when they really, Dope Smokers, of course, Sleep's second album, their best and their most intense. It's one song and it's 59 minutes long, you know. When they re-released, they put it out on record, and of course they broke it up over four sides. So I was like, well, what's the point of that? It's like the point is that it's one song with no breaks. So if you break it up, that kind of breaks the effect. But everybody wanted the record and not the CD, which makes no sense to me. I mean, I understand it makes sense, but I think it's kind of silly. So the point of this is – and a lot of live stuff comes out on three, you know, Against Me, I think, did a triple live album set. I think maybe Bad Religion. A lot of bands do like this triple and even quadruple live album set. To me, it just seems kind of annoying and tedious and monotonous. I think a CD or a double CD makes a hell of a lot more sense for a extended live show. But I bought this anyways because it looks cool. But still.
That's got to be expensive, John. Tell me how expensive that is.
$50, baby. $50.
$50 for it. But four LPs, you know, you think about four LPs for $50, that's a good price. But I suppose when you consider that it's only one thing.
It never feels that way, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I have a hard time with these box sets. Like, I was looking at the, like, Replacements Twin Tone Years, and it's four LPs, but it's $75. I'm like, man. Like, I think I'd rather buy them each for $20 than buy all of them for $75. You know, I don't know.
Whenever I see one of these gigantic prolonged live albums, it always strikes me as more of a product than an artistic statement. Yeah, did you not mention like the Bad Religion one a second ago?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
yeah. They like where basically it is so packed with material that it seems like they're really trying to give you, you know, give you value for your money so that you will buy this thing, more so than they're necessarily thinking that this is a great listening experience. You know what I mean? Like, that's what it always strikes me as. It's a thing for a fan to buy. Someone like a John Gentile that's going to go drop $50 on a release. That's who this is for.
I agree. Well, I guess what I'm getting at is this format with a record, the format does service to the art. You know, with Effed Up's album, with Dosha Dreams, the format did justice to the record because it kind of broke it up into movements and sections. Here, four records does a disservice to the art because it breaks it up. A concert is one continuous thing, and when I have a live album, I want to get as close to the live experience as I can. And where a CD would get closer to what you mean, that here, eight sides of a record just takes you out of that element, you know. So it does disservice to me. It seems to be blind
allegiance to the format.
Yeah, blind. They like all records are the best, but why? Here they're not, you know. So you know, so here it's records for record's sake, rather than records for music's sake. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, 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 yeah.
I wonder. I bet you that's fair. I mean, how many of those are they selling? 500? 1,000?
Oh no, Sleep on like Sleep's album on vinyl was one of the highest selling vinyl records of the year. It actually like Third Man, like they sold out so quickly. Third Man had to do an immediate second press. Like the demand was way higher than they thought it was going to be. This won't be as high as that because it's expensive. I'll say they'll probably move 5,000 to 10,000, which is a lot.
Of the four, man.
Sleep's pretty. I'll give you guys some inside baseball. Let me think. If I was at a concert and a guy that was running the concert told me how much merch they sold, is that fair game for me to say publicly?
Let me put
it this way. Sleep sells at one show enough merchandise that would dwarf most bands that we talk about their annual income. Like they sell a lot of merch at one show. You know.
See, what kind of places they play when they tour? Once again, 1,000 seaters. It's not like they're playing.
Not about 3,000 seaters, but everybody buys merch. Everybody.
Because they're all stoned out of their brains.
Well, and metal guys,
they all wake up the next day. They're like, "Oh my god, what do I need this crap for?"
And metal guys love, but see, metal guys are like, "Yeah, check out my sleep T-shirt." And me too, you know. So,
yeah,
sleep. They're awesome. I wish there was a CD version of this though.
For who?
For me.
Oh.
Yeah, because it could fit on one or two CDs.
I think two. I think it's over 80 minutes.
Wow, they just make like a laser disc that's like 4 feet wide, and you could fit all of it on
there. I had a laser disc player and I loved it. It was ridiculous, and I loved it.
Why not microfiche and cassette? And you could put your cassette on and slowly crank the microfiche thing.
John, tell us about Kicker and their new song.
Kicker's putting out a third album. Kicker, of course, is fronted by Pete the Roadie, a legendary guy. He roadied for Amoebix. He roadied for Jello Biafra. He roadied for Fugazi. He roadied for Subhumans. He roadied for everybody. Now he's fronting the band called Kicker, which also includes Dave of Neurosis, Mouse of Dystopia, and on drums, Dave Mello of Operation Ivy. Very interesting. They're putting out their third album. It's called Pure Drivel. They released one track called Wankers on the Bus. And it's basically, you know, follows in the vein of the first two Kicker records, kind of semi-humorous UK 82 style smashing. It's great. I love Kicker. This is going to be cool. Check it out.
I have also listened to this album. I'm sure you've listened to the album already, John.
Yes.
And it's pretty good. Even though Pete, as a front man, is fairly one-dimensional. It's good stuff.
Pete, as a front man, is actually, actually amazingly good in that, like...
Well, I haven't seen him live, so I can't speak to that, but his delivery, it's like he has one delivery.
Yeah, it's called punk, Tom. It's called punk.
You know? Whatever, John. You're the guy who's always making fun of... You're always making fun of me for my enjoying, like... punk music that actually sounds like punk music. I've been referred to as an orthodox punk fan. Now all of a sudden you're flipping the script and defending this sort of,
because Pete flips the script back, in that even though he sounds like an orthodox punker, the songs are amusingly self-aware and often quite clever. So where
I like the band. I'm not trying to.
We do a good job disguising it.
Well, I'm just saying, he does what he does. He sort of shouts this mid-tempo, you know, shouting, and it's, but yeah, the lyrics are funny. It kind of has that kind of, it reminds me of sometimes of like the more tongue-in-cheek Motorhead song, sort of.
Oh, see, honestly, it reminds me of UK Subs, but funny. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I can hear that. But anyway, it's cool stuff. I'm not dissing Kicker. I think everybody should go check him out.
And if you ever see Kicker live, go talk to Pete. He really is who he seems to be on record. Like, he is one of a kind. He's amazing. He's amazing.
I was doing a little research, and I actually reread your interview with him that you did for Punk News. It was pretty funny. You were trying to get him to dish dirt on, like, the people he roadied for, and he's like a psychiatrist. He won't divulge any information.
Yeah. Well, let's mention that real quick. Pete is amazing. He'd be like, Pete, so you roadied for Amoebix, you roadied for Subhumans, you know, you roadied for Crass. I can't remember. Maybe he did roadie for Crass. Anyways, so Pete, you know, what happened on the road? And he's like, nothing interesting. I'm like, what do you mean?
What was the wildest thing that ever happened? Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's like a lawyer or a doctor. He won't tell you anything about what happened on the road, which I think is amazing.
You even know? Like Jello, you know, I have a person I know pretty well who's had some real personal interactions with Jello, who's given me a lot of great,
who's like, that
inside information. So my uncle Tim lives in San Francisco, and he has for many, many years, and he's been making a documentary about a bunch of the old school San Francisco punk bands. It all started because when he first moved out there, he dated a woman who played bass in Flipper, and it doesn't matter. But anyway, so you have to get Jello if you're doing a documentary about San Francisco stuff, right? So I know he'd had some interaction with Jello before, but he had to get Jello to be a part of his documentary. And it's a pretty funny story. I don't really want to talk a whole lot about it, but let's just say that the only way he could end up getting to him was by sending his girlfriend, more or less.
Yeah,
because Jell-O has a certain weakness, certain weaknesses, it seems, as we all do, you know. But anyway, but I hear a lot of people be pretty candid about what they think about Jell-O, and maybe you and I have even had a conversation, but I don't know. But and I'm not looking to speak evil about Jell-O. But
Jell-O's always been nice to me.
He's definitely a character.
I'll defend Jell-O. Jell-O to me has always been very unique, but a class act. But he certainly is a character for sure. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. What the hell are we talking about?
Adam, what do you think? Should we keep rolling? Anything you want to talk about? Should we wrap it up? What do you think?
What's on the clock? I got an hour 21 on mine. That's without songs. Let's wrap her up here, and we can
I need a shower really bad.
Circle back.
I can hardly stamp,
so. Tom is just dripping. So anyways,
I'm not dripping. It's like 10 degrees, but
if anyone wants to send us an email, podcast@punknews.org is how you do that. I'll send you all off with a song. There's a band from Ottawa, Ontario called Dogma. They're a peace punk band in the crass, lineage, everything down to the to their album art is just, you know, straight up an homage to the crass universe and those types of bands. But they're really good and they're really fun. So this is from a demo tape that they released in October of last year. I'm going to play a song called Up and Coming. So this is Up and Coming by Dogma. See you later.